Brushes with Fame or Seven Little Frictions? Wood on Stone. Metal on Metal. Steel on Plastic. Satin on Wood. Skin on Silk. Nylon on Nylon. Atmosphere on Hessian.
I'm here at Intermarts with Gillian Waring. Her solo show of new work continues her fascination with the hopes, fears and lives of Londoners. Deciding to return to people who have previously participated in her work, she has illustrated in photographs and documents their current preoccupations and how they imagine their lives developing by the millennium. We as viewers are taken on a somewhat voyeuristic journey into the intimacy of their diverse and sometimes highly disturbed concerns. Gillian, 2 points about this show. Firstly, you've returned to people you previously used. Why did you decide to do this? And secondly, you've used photography rather than video. And maybe we could just talk first of all about that, and then look at the first piece here, Helen, and discuss her and her relationship to you.
Right. The project first started for a magazine called Documon, that's a magazine in France, and they wanted me to come up with, as a guest editor, to do an article in the magazine, and their guest editor means that you do an artist project. And I was thinking of the title of the magazine, which was about documents, and then thinking about what a lot of my work is concerned with, And I just came up with the idea, knowing that there was 4 years left of the millennium at the time they asked me to do the project. I was thinking about, I have actually been working with people for the last 4 years, and maybe it would be a good idea to ask them about their previous 4 years and what they imagine the future is, which I think a lot of people don't want to actually think about. I knew it would be quite difficult for them to maybe project. I know that I'd find it very difficult to project into the future. And I think it would uncover a lot of things that probably I have missed out in the work about, you know, all the moments that there's things about these people that we probably haven't discussed. And I thought it'd be quite interesting drawing some more information out of them. And I thought of using photographs, because over the years I've taken photographs. Every time I do a project with someone, I take a series of photographs to keep as kind of research material. And so some of the photographs in the show today are those that I didn't think I was going to show originally, but they've become part of this sort of, I suppose, this diaristic thing I've kept up along the way. So, and I just thought it would be good to have a still photograph, and then with the have them to write, because there's so much more people give away different things in different forms. I think they've said things here that I know they wouldn't have said to my face on camera. So I think they've revealed more to me than I imagine they would. A couple of people have anyway.
They knew this work was going to be in an exhibition, obviously, yeah. And they didn't seem to have any problems writing these documents for you.
Well, I do know these people now, so I think it's easier for them to maybe be more personal about their lives. So originally it was for a magazine in France, and then I told them it was going to go into an exhibition, so no, that wasn't a problem. But I think as in with a lot of projects I've done over the years, people actually enjoy it once they've done it, because they want to. It gives them something to think about. Helen, the photograph of Helen, this is a photograph I took in 1993, which was, again, a sort of like a photograph I took after I'd done the sort of project. And the piece was called Take Your Top Off, originally. And that was me in bed with, it was a series of three photographs, me in bed with three different transsexuals. And Helen, in this photograph here, is holding a cable release, and she's in her bed and she's topless. And in this photograph, which I took also in 1993, there's the photograph of Helen by herself, topless in bed, holding the cable release, which I think portrays her as looking quite isolated.
Right, if we just move over here to the second diptych in the exhibition of three, which are in this first room, we come to Brian, which is an altogether more disturbing image and text than the Helen piece.
Yes, I was quite surprised with the writing that Brian sent me, because the thing that he actually writes about is that he was involved with raping a woman and he's been in prison, and it's actually quite tragic writing, which I've known Brian now for 2 years, and I knew he had a violent streak, but he's someone who's completely inarticulate, and we just never talked about his previous life, or even if I tried to, he would never offer any information. So I was quite surprised that he actually gave away quite a lot in the note he wrote to me. And the photograph shows him with a T-shirt over his head, because I think even though he's been in my work, which he's been in group situations in my work, I'm not going to point him out to people. I think it's best if his identity was protected, and that was one of the reasons why we set up a scenario where his identity is undercover as such. But this was quite shocking when I first read. And also the way it's written, it's quite phonetic, and it's quite hard to actually, you have to work out what is actually going on there, because the spelling is pretty unique.
And so it's also in black and white, whereas the other images are in colour.
There's two in black and white.
Oh, there's two in black and white.
Yeah, I did try to take photographs in both colour and black and white, just some seemed to serve the mood better that they were in black and white. There's no real sort of conceptual motive behind that. This is the image that worked and seemed to sum up his emotional turmoil, really. And I think a lot of my work, which I think I've been concerned with over the years, is people's inability to maybe express themselves in normal terms. And because I'm always quite interested in, you know, even though you're supposedly inarticulate, that you can still express yourself. And I think this is actually the most expressive letter in a way, even though it's the most inarticulate. And it says you can understand the emotions much more than you can, I think, some of the other pieces. It's quite powerful in that sense, I think.
Moving across the room now to Lynn. This is different again, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about how the image here works with the text, because it works in a quite different way from the Brahan piece.
Yes, it was the shot that I took, because I was taking a video at the time, and the photograph is of Lynn with a hose pipe hosing a woman who's got, they've both got T-shirts on, which have got slogans on, and it's in a sort of suburban type garden, and it's, to a certain extent, it looks quite like, say, maybe like soft porn, maybe, I don't know. It was actually for a wet T-shirts video I made, which I never showed because I thought it was quite puerile, but the photographs came out more interesting than the video. And Lynn, actually, is another transsexual that I've worked with, who's actually much more successful physically than maybe Helen, but has also recently sort of suffered because of the drugs that she's taken. She's having a lot of problems with the side effects. And when I first met Lynn, she was extremely optimistic and doing a lot of shows. And I'm quite surprised that her whole personality's changed. It's almost like she's become slightly schizophrenic due to these drugs. And I was quite surprised, because I've been trying to keep in contact with her, because we've been to fairgrounds and done things together, that she actually wrote about her not even thinking that she would make it to the millennium, and that it's actually her life has become quite depressing. This just doesn't actually, you can't actually work that out from the photograph. It's actually something, this is the photograph, is a lot younger than the note that she wrote. So there's that sort of juxtaposition of, there is sort of a time lapse between when I took the photograph and what she's saying. And I don't think she could do a piece like this now. I don't think she could be involved in one of my videos, because she finds it very hard to get out of bed. And I was quite surprised that, returning back to Lynn, that things have changed quite drastically.
We're in the second room now, where they're just two diptychs, and I feel that there's a little bit of a difference between this room and the other room. This room feels more optimistic in how people are writing, and it's less a sense of almost surviving to the millennium as actually having a real future beyond. So if we talk about the first piece here, Roger and Peter.
Yeah, Roger and Peter, I originally met them in 1994 and we did some photographs together, and sort of became interested in their sort of lifestyle and them as a couple, really, because Roger was doing drag acts and it was just very simple, and it was all about their whether people perceived them as a couple, because they would walk together in a supermarket or in the park, people would thought that Peter was Roger's son because he was actually quite small, so from behind they couldn't work out the relationship. Then they were quite shocked to find out that they were lovers, so it started off from just sort of like how people perceive them as a couple. And they are much more optimistic than the other room, but there's always a sort of a slight hint that they're sort of cautious about the future. And though I think for a lot of people they'd like to see reach a lot of goals by the millennium, I think theirs is, I think, can be quite realistic, because they want to open a bed and breakfast for gay couples, or just gay single people. And I think they probably will be able to achieve that, but they know that he's got to do a lot of work that he's probably not happy with, because he's a painter and decorator. And he has to keep his sexuality secret from the people at work as well. So there's this kind of slightly double life he has to lead. Even with the sort of like the drag acts he was doing, he had to keep that secret from what the people that work in the painting and decorating business, because of being scared of being pushed out of getting any employment. So there's always this kind of thing that people I meet, that they have, you know, this, they've got to cope with so many facets just to keep themselves going, really. There's things that sound optimistic, and I suppose in our lives we've got things that we always have to struggle against. And I think because I've been working with people over the years, and sort of maybe we've all got that, it's just that I see it more because I have been talking about.
The second piece in this room, Stephen, Danny, Daniel and Ryan, I know is also part of a series or work in progress you did for Life Live in Paris.
The piece I did, which was called Boy Time, was a video of the four boys that I met over this summer, actually, sitting very quietly for an hour, and then they were rigged up with microphones so they could say what they wanted to under their breath, which, you know, being cheeky young boys, they said quite a few things. And but I tried to keep as still as possible, which Ryan, being the cheekiest one, that's on the photograph, shows them up against the wall, and Ryan's the boy who decided to take his pants down. And who's actually, quite surprisingly, the leader and the bully at the four boys, and he's the smallest, he's 12, and there's one that's 15, one that's 16, and one that's 14, and he can actually control the whole group. But yes, I thought I'd do something against nature for the video, which I thought getting four boys to sit still was quite a difficult task, but it sort of worked, and they actually... quite good, maybe. They're still very cheeky. But there is definitely the most optimistic pieces of writing, because they have got their whole life in front of them to start off with. And but they're still, again, they have this kind of... I was quite surprised how realistic they were about life. Like Stephen talks about getting his sisters through their difficult teenage years, and he's still a teenager himself. I found that quite surprising, that he actually could look back only over the past few years and see it as being difficult. With sometimes you can only work that out later on in life rather than just, you know, immediately in it. So I thought that was quite poignant. And and then Ryan talks about his bike being nicked, and then he buys another bike and then that gets nicked, and that's quite a humorous one, I think. But on the whole, I think they have a realistic vision of there might be employment. You know, they're not asking maybe for an awful lot for the future. They're thinking of getting married and quite sort of, maybe well-paid jobs, but nothing that's sort of out of reach.
With a lot of these characters, I mean, how have you actually met them? I mean, I know some of them you've met, yeah, like with the Time Out advert that you did, and you met people through that. But, I mean, these people, quite a few of them, you've had quite a long, enduring relationship with, in terms of knowing them and using them. How did you first come across them? Were they just random people that you met, or...?
With a lot of my work, it's sometimes I've managed to get people through, like the transsexuals, through a society called the Gender Dysphoria Society, which they keep on renewing names to make it sound less like it's a maybe transsexual, but I thought gender dysphoria sounds worse than the terminology transsexual. And other people I have sometimes just bumped into on the street. With the boys, I was just had a camera on me during this summer, last summer, and just saw these four kids knocking around the streets and just decided to take some photographs. And I didn't take their names or telephone numbers. And when I was thinking of this idea with having kids just sitting around, I immediately thought back to them, and I just knew they lived around the corner, but I still knew it'd be quite hard to... If I hadn't got an address, they could be living in quite a few of the estates around Bermondsey. But very luckily, I bumped immediately into Stephen's nephew, who I just showed this photograph to this young boy saying, "Do you know any of these four lads?" And they said, "Yes, that one's my nephew." So I was probably lucky in that case, getting back in contact with the four boys there. But it's all very... There's no real one system. I don't like to see myself as doing things in a formulaic way. I think a lot of the work and the people I keep in contact with is because I feel I have an intuitive feel about them. Maybe there's something I recognise in them. That might be a character trait in someone I knew from years ago, or something I'm trying to find things in people that haven't maybe been very well articulated via other mediums, or and just trying to find these other things that you don't see in documentaries or on television, and trying to find out other nuances in people that, cause, you know, there's such a wealth of difference out there, and I'm just trying to chip away and find my own sort of truths or what people think their truths are in life.
Also, you cite as your influences things like video diaries. Do you think that's fair? Do you think you were influenced by this kind of video nation that we've now perhaps become?
Yeah. The very original video diaries I was very interested in. I'm always interested in anything that starts off with a certain naivety about it, because I also think some of the best things televisual-wise on documentaries are when there hasn't yet been a precedent set, so people are going out there very naively, and the sort of filmmakers are naive, and maybe the people are naive, and so they don't know what to give, so they give, they're both very generous. And I think as soon as the formula set, which was for video diaries, the people who are the next applicants for it are very aware of what all the other people have done before them, and maybe then overreact to the situation, rather than maybe more being more naturalistic, or they're probably just very aware of how they can be presented on television. And as soon as anyone becomes very aware of how to present themselves, then you're not really getting the true self, which is normally something that is more, when you go try and get people to break down their barriers and be much more natural, and I think then, which is a very hard thing to do. And that's what I'm always trying to get, really, to try and capture something that feels like it's natural but hasn't been seen before, which is very difficult.
Rodney Graham, we're in the Listen Gallery in your exhibition, and I think there are several strands that I can detect in your work, one of which is that you seem to be interested in recontextualizing the sorts of constituencies of modernism, but also the protocols of 19th century European culture. But here we are in the first floor gallery, where you have objects that refer to small trolleys, but they also refer to minimalism and Donald Judd in particular. Perhaps we should start by you talking about this piece.
These kind of came out of a series of sculptures that I made that were essentially bookshelves. And that in turn came out of the problem of that I ran into in the early 80s when I was making making book works. And I was concerned with the problem of exhibiting them, putting them in vitrines that wasn't the appropriate way to show them, et cetera. So I thought, I started thinking about designing bookshelves. And then, of course, when I started along that track, I started thinking of Judd. And it occurred to me that Judd's sculptures make exemplary bookshelves. And so I made a whole series of kind of ironic juxtapositions of Judd structures with Freud. Freud, volumes of Freud, usually from the Hogarth Press standard edition, because I was interested in working with Freud at the time. Subsequently, I did the these sort of children's trolleys that parody the modular Judd works of the, I guess, of the late 70s and 80s, which have, in this case, they're designed around a single volume of a Dr. Seuss children's book with different colored panels. And I added the wheels to add a kind of movement element of possible movement in them. And they're essentially in a sense, they're sculptures for children and you know, housing or encapsulating children's books. Or like, they could be seen as large mobile slipcases for books, too.
They also challenge the formality and seriousness, all in a sense, of minimalist art and of works on the gallery wall, because here they are, in a sense, represented as trolleys. They're mobile, aren't they? So that sense of gravity and stability is denied.
Yeah, I thought in terms of placement of the works, you can't get obviously too precious with the placement of a work like this. It can be kicked and pushed around the room, so it can be relocated by the spectator. So I was thinking of playing a little bit on that idea too. Although I guess there's some configurations that are more interesting than others. For these works, I wanted to work with children's books, and I wanted to work with more color than I usually work with, and I just couldn't seem to escape from this Judd paradigm. I find it's the only sculpture I can make is these parodies of Judd. I just can't seem to move on, because it's, for me, it is like a it's so canonical, his work, and always for me as a student and as an art student, my idea of a perfect exhibition would be a Judd exhibition, to walk into a room of minimal sculptures. So when I think of close my ideas and think of a sculpture, I'm afraid I only think of Judd.
In the sense that Judd is a very classical artist, and as I was saying earlier, you've somehow dislocated that idea of classicism by putting these, reducing them to child scale. They're about, 12 to 17 inches high, but also putting them onto wheels, and a lot of children's toys actually are on wheels. But there is also the reference that I believe interests you, which is that of, again, the ironic ready-made, not exactly things taken from real life in Duchampian sense, but things taken from art life.
Yeah, I think that there was a period. This is like, I think for me, the tail end of that kind of, my interest in that kind of appropriation. I have to say, I'm kind of thinking of moving in other directions, and I'm trying not. I don't want to get my work to be too turned in on itself in terms of referring only to the art world and art world concerns. In a way, I guess this was even a way of putting the books in it as a way of trying to break out into something else, into literature, because there's always a literary component in my work, sometimes a frustrated one, but it's usually there.
Yeah, perhaps you could elaborate a bit on the literary book reference here.
Specifically here, I mean, they are the books that are inserted in the sculptures are children's books by the American author Dr. Seuss. I don't know whether they're so popular here. They're very, very popular, kind of sort of nonsense books that have been popular for about 20 years. In fact, Dr. Seuss was been writing them for the last 20 or 30 years. I think he just died last year. It's a pseudonym, of course. But partly because they were glossy, and excuse me, I'm going to remove one, because they were large format glossy books and they could be easily inserted. And I basically built the color. I designed the color scheme around the color of the book in each case.
I see. If we can just describe what you've just done, in fact, which surprised me. You've taken a hardback book out of this small bookcase structure.
Yes. Yeah. It's just one. This piece is called Bartholomew and the Oobleck, and it's just a children's book by Dr. Seuss.
As we're in this upstairs space, you have another series of framed, are they photo works, on the wall with a title of Aerodynamic Forms in Space, 1 to 11. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about these.
I just printed these for this exhibition specifically. I did them, I shot them actually in 1977, I think, if my memory serves me correctly. It was a long time ago, and I think it was 77. And I was kind of reminded of them because I was thinking of the specific room, facing the fact that it has a view out onto the schoolyard. And I remember I shot these pictures in a schoolyard across from where I lived, and that kind of just triggered a connection. But they're small sort of foam and balsa wood and plastic glider models that have been quote-unquote incorrectly assembled and placed on a white card and photographed with very intense sunlight on them, so the shadows form kind of an abstract pattern. At this time, when I shot them, I was kind of interested in constructivism and in Lissitzky, and specifically trying to make like abstract compositions, but out of a kind of with an absurdist element or a playful element of using. So I thought of them as like a series of design errors, and the title aerodynamic forms in space is kind of ironic. They look like they're kind of floating in space because they've gone more blue with age. That's a white background, but the photograph is a little blue, and with over time the transparencies seem to go more and more blue. So just fortuitous, and I knew they were going to be exhibited with the children's trolleys, and I was thinking in terms of something playful in relationship to the playground in the space, because you can hardly avoid it in this gallery. You always have to deal, it seems to me, most artists who exhibit in this room have to deal with this relationship to the playground, which is always full of children.
And the ideas of ambiguity and contradiction and opposition are here, aren't they? Because I read them in very much that dual way. On the one hand, I can see them as like the Lipsky abstractions, but then I keep spotting the glider plane in them, but they sort of oscillate between those two kinds of ideas.
Yeah, I was interested in at a time when I was actually trying to move into sculpture out of my earliest photographic work, and in the same way I was trying to develop kind of photographic systems to develop more, you know, to be able to with sort of self-generating photographic systems. I was thinking of this, it could be kind of endless, just by reconstructing and reconstructing these models in a so-called incorrect way, and then placing them differently in relationship to the sun. It played an infinite possible number of compositions, but it always does come, you can always tell what it is, that it isn't just a toy.
But rather like the idea of the loop, which occurs in a lot of the texts that I've read about your work, that it can repeat itself endlessly.
Yeah, I've always worked with loops, and I don't quite know why, except with my first book pieces, a lens, an early book piece, I was in a sense trying to build up through the repetition of the binding structure of the book, of the loop text, build up a kind of sculptural, build up the sculptural dimension of a book, like a book 3/4 inch thick, but rather laboriously constructed through through words and signatures and binding sequences together. I mean, the ultimate aim is the difference between making a book in an art context and making a book as a writer. Something I've discovered in conversation with writers is that you're always, as an artist, you're really always thinking of the book in a sculptural way, and you know, if you're making a book, you really are making it as a sculpture. And so I like thinking back from the thickness and the size of the book to the process by which that thickness would be constituted, and I wanted to do that in a very materialist way, by sticking to the elements of it. And loops do that because they repeat and, you know, generate more pages, and sort of an effective way of sculpturally creating a book. So
We'll go downstairs now, but there's also that tension between the objectivity in the way you've just been talking about the book, but also the subjectivity, and you've made books about Freud, where there's a tension there, and you've reinvested the object with another kind of value.
Yeah, on one level, I mean, you could say ultimately, and the Freud works, I think you're talking about, in some cases are interpolations into a text, where I really am kind of making a minute alteration to the thickness of an existing book by adding two or three pages, but the subject matter in this case is important. I would add that millimeter or so of thickness only because I had something to say at a certain point. In other words, I could actually add to the text and write something and interpolate and insert it in. But I think in the end, I mean, it's trivial, obviously, to add this thin dimension to a book, but I kind of interested in that kind of triviality in a way.
Should we go downstairs? We can continue. Now we're downstairs, and there's a video monitor as well as a series of works on the wall, and I believe the title of this installation is Schema, Complications of Payment, and we can hear the videotape in the background, but perhaps you could describe physically what we're looking at here.
Okay. The three elements of this work are a painting 6.5 by 9 feet, a 50-minute videotape of a lecture which I gave at the University of British Columbia in the mathematics building, not as part of any program at the university, but I hired the space and used it because the classroom was appropriate. And a series of, actually exhibited our 12 posters advertising the talk with different titles. The idea was, I was dealing with, in this piece, with a subject matter that I dealt with before in previous works, such as Freud Supplement 178 to 170D. It deals with material relevant to one of Freud's dreams, the dream of the botanical monograph, a dream that I've been fascinated with for some time. The painting actually is not so much a painting as a diagram or a flow chart indicating the flow of monies to and from Sigmund Freud around the time of this dream and relative to a debt owed, that he owed to a former colleague and money owed to him by one of his patients. The lecture that you hear in the background is a lecture in which I explain this diagram. So in a way, in the course of explaining, it's really, I saw it as a lecture explaining a painting, but at the same time, the painting is a diagram which supports the lecture. So the subject matter is somewhere between the two. And the set of posters I kind of used as notes for the, notes for myself. The posters have different titles. And I could go into detail on this, in terms of the actual, to generalize about it, I can just say it's sort of about on one hand, it's about, to me, about painting and diagram, the difference or the lack of difference between a painting and a diagram, the relationship between painting and video, because the video is explanatory. The video is absolutely necessary to understand the painting, insofar as the painting is a diagram. Insofar as it's a painting, I suppose it doesn't need that explanation, but it really makes no sense without the video. And the video really makes very little sense without the painting.
But you're actually making a sort of a critical analysis of an episode in the life of a group of 19th century individuals to do with infrastructure, economic background, social context. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, why you choose to work with that sort of material.
It's sort of, I didn't so much choose it as it kind of chose me, in the sense that it came out of an interest in Freud's dreams, which I pursued, and in the course of that, I encountered this slightly strange and amusing problem encountered by Freud, which I can explain if you want me to go through it. I should explain it here. In this, there are four different people represented on this painting. There's in the middle, you have Sigmund Freud himself. On the top of the painting, a number of representations of Joseph Breuer, his former colleague and his creditor, and below him, a patient of Freud's, who's also who owes Freud money and who is related to Breuer. And the dilemma that this painting represents is this dilemma that Freud found himself in around the time of the dream that I'm analyzing in the earlier works. Freud had at one had incurred a debt of 2,300 florins to his friend Breuer. He had borrowed from Breuer over the years 2,300 florins. He'd just begun paying it back in installments. He proposed to pay to Breuer this debt back in 500 installments, starting with 500 installments of 500 florins. So he sends the first 500 florins to Breuer, who sends the money, sends 350 florins and a receipt for 500 florins to Freud's wife, who then forwards it to Freud. The reason he does this is because they're not speaking to, or at least Breuer is not speaking directly to Freud, so he feels compelled to go through the intermediary of Freud's wife. The reason he sends back 350 florins and a receipt for 500 florins is that his niece, Fraulein C., represented down below here, had come to Freud for treatment and owed Freud, had given Freud a deposit of 150 florins for 500 florins worth of analytic treatment. You see this flow diagram indicates the 500 florins in, of service, in, of analytic service. It was understood that she would pay the remaining 350 florins when her mother died. Her mother is represented here. When her mother, when she inherited the money from her mother, she would forward that money to Freud. But Breuer had taken upon it himself to pay this debt. Obviously, the mother had not died yet, but Freud had taken it upon himself to assume this debt. And in the letter in which he has enclosed the sum of money, he argues this point to Freud. Freud subsequently sends the 350 florins back to Breuer, arguing for the separation of the debt, saying that in fact she had asked to pay like anyone else. Breuer subsequently returns again through Martha Freud. He keeps the money, but returns a receipt for 850 florins. And what interested me was the dilemma that Freud now found himself in, that he could only, every time he would send an installment, obviously Breuer would send a receipt for a larger amount of money. And the only way he could really discharge this debt is when his patient had paid him, and the only way that that could happen is when her mother died, who was also a relative of Breuer. So the kind of relationship between professional and personal kind of services, relationships, is kind of complicated and amusing. And I dealt with this material specifically in some other works and in a written way, but it occurred to me at one point when I was making a diagram of it, it would be interesting to make a kind of a large, kind of almost like a history painting diagram of this particular dilemma, which I suppose everybody can relate to on one level or another. Everybody can put themselves in the place of one of these people at any one time of their life or another.
It's another series of loops, isn't it? But they're not loops that are all continuous, because as you say, you have a simple profit and loss balance account loop, yep, or set of loops, but you also have the other loops to do with personal support and personal favour and so on. Right, well, shall we just go to the sort of upstairs bit in the back of the downstairs gallery? Now, if you could describe, it's a little vehicle, isn't it? US yeah. Mail parcel post.
It's a little, it's a model of circa 1904 US mail delivery wagon, a rural delivery wagon that's been converted into a camera obscura. It's a model of an actually existing carriage that I had fabricated last spring, and which exists now as a permanent installation in an arboretum in Rouen, in France. It relates to it's part of a series of camera obscuras that I've made since 1979, or models for camera obscuras, proposals for camera obscuras. This one is only the second one that I actually realized. I was asked to do an installation in this arboretum in France, which is made up of mostly North American species of trees that were brought over in the 18th century and planted on the property of the chateau called the Arboretum de Harcourt. And I eventually came up with the idea of making a mobile camera obscura, room that you could sit in. There would be a screen wall, and you could look at an image of what was outside on this screen wall, but I wanted to make one that could be moved around to various locations. And at the same time, I wanted to make something that was kind of fairly unintrusive in terms of the kind of historical milieu of the place. And I thought a kind of a period carriage, even if it wasn't of exactly the same vintage as the castle, like a kind of a period carriage would be something that would be kind of tourist friendly and appropriate, not too shocking. And at the same time, I wanted to have a slight disjunction, and I did. And in looking through some catalogs of various carriage types, I found this very modest mail carriage. The original exists in a museum in Rhode Island in America, and I found a fabricator, in fact, a carriage manufacturer, one of the few around, who actually had worked in this museum, knew the prototype, and I had an exact replica made of the carriage. And then I had this camera apparatus installed. Working with a friend who's a specialist in optics and another friend who's an architect, I had this this camera apparatus attached to the back of the carriage. Basically, it would be like a large format, kind of like a 24 by 24 inch camera in a teak box that folds out, and the focal length of the lens is about 5 feet. So if you're there's a hole in the back of the carriage, if you're sitting inside the carriage with the door shut and the lights off, and you're facing a circular screen on which the inverted image of the landscape outside is projected. Again, I'm interested in this kind of just simple inversion of the landscape.
Okay, shall we move now to the other work? And in fact, in the background, we can hear, it sounds like a film in a large wooden box or wooden structure. Spherical image with little spots of light.
Yeah, this piece is called Coruscating Cinnamon Granules, and it's a 16-millimeter film of documenting a very simple action that I undertook in my kitchen. I covered the spiral electric element on the stove, one of the stove elements, with cinnamon granules, and set a camera up above the element at a slight angle, and then just turn the element on, allowing the cinnamon granules to kind of scintillate and sparkle as they burnt. And then in the course of it, I sprinkled a few extra granules on just to kind of keep the spectacle going, so to speak. You can see it coming now, the spiral shape kind of coming into. It kind of relates to a number of pieces that I've done, lighting works, kind of lighting installations that I've done. Essentially, it came out of early experiments with flash photography, Polaroid flash photography, working at night in darkness. But I was interested in kind of domesticating this kind of activity, and also making something that to me was like very rudimentary, kind of experimental film of the. Of the 20s or something very, very, very simple. And it's shown in the cinema. It's basically the size of my kitchen.
Right.
So it's a very intimate scale. We have real cinema seats here.
I mean, it has all those references, but also I understand it has reference to Canadian sort of farmhouses where cinnamon is used as a kind of a material to create a scent or an odor in a room, which then becomes synonymous with the home.
Yeah. Well, this was actually the technique was taught to me by my wife, who learned it from her mother, and it's just it's a technique just for actually removing unwanted kitchen smells. But you put, I mean, it's something that probably is used done over here too, I suppose. I don't know, but it creates a pleasant odor when you and the sparkling effect is kind of secondary, but obviously in this context I featured it by filming it with the lights. The only light in the film is the light of the element as it comes up. As you can see, it's coming up and going down again. It's also used by real estate salesmen when they're to create a kind of home-like atmosphere, an apartment or a condominium. When they're showing it to a prospective client, they'll just put a little bit on before the client comes in. It creates this very pleasant smell. Obviously, the smell isn't part of the work, but you can kind of imagine it.
I mean, it also has a reference. I don't know whether this is of any significance to, of course, Smithson Spiral Jetty.
Yeah, I was thinking very consciously of because I always, Smithson is very important to me, and I was thinking of making a reference to that. Yeah. To the Spiral Jetty film and to other, it seems to be kind of like really like a film that Smithson might have made. In fact,